there are certain like discrepancies between the dominant Western discourse and China's domestic discourse. And I think at least we should bring those two discourses together and carefully analyze what is actually happening instead of assuming like one of them is correct and one of them is simply liar.
Hi, I'm Taylor Owen, and this is Big Tech. When we talk about Chinese big tech, it usually sounds something like this.
We're looking at TikTok. We may be banning TikTok. We may be doing some other things. There are a couple of options.
Obviously, Kelly, the concern is the security risk here in terms of how TikTok handles user data and whether or not it goes back to China or the Communist Party.
By 2020, they will have caught up. By 2025, they will be better than us. And by 2030, they will dominate the industries of AI.
That's Donald Trump talking about the social media platform TikTok. And former Google CEO Eric Schmidt talking about the rise of Chinese AI. These clips reflect increasingly common narratives around China's tech industry, which is usually positioned in direct conflict with American companies and American values. A narrative of a digital Cold War, whereby the only thing that can stop a rising China is American ingenuity, is deeply self-serving for Silicon Valley and is being used to help them stave off domestic regulation. But Hong Shen says this narrative risks getting the very history and nature of Chinese technology wrong. Hong is a systems scientist at Carnegie Mellon and the author of a new book called Alibaba, Infrastructuring Global China. Hong argues that China's tech sector is actually deeply intertwined with the global economy. Alibaba, for instance, was at one time primarily owned by Yahoo and SoftBank. And Western technology companies often rely on Chinese labor in their supply chains, both to build their hardware and to train their AI. She also argues that Chinese tech isn't simply an extension of the state, as Jack Ma can attest. So this us-versus-them arms race narrative, propagated by both Silicon Valley CEOs and the U.S. government, is, according to Shen, fraught to say the least. This is the first of two episodes we're going to do on China this season. The next one will focus on China's domestic surveillance network and the technologies that are being used to survey and oppress the country's minorities and which are increasingly being exported to illiberal regimes around the world. There are obviously deeply concerning human rights violations happening in China right now, many of which are enabled by technology. And the expansion of Chinese tech into other parts of the world may be cause for genuine security concerns. But framing the Chinese tech sector as simply an adversary to Silicon Valley in the US doesn't tell the whole story. It glosses over just how interconnected the Chinese and American tech industries really are. So here, to complicate this story for us, is Hong Shen. I want to start with one of the more common narratives around the Chinese state and the internet, which you could broadly sort of characterize as the Chinese government fearing the democratizing potential of the internet, built a firewall that allowed them to both restrict information from the outside world and control the information from within China that its citizens received. What does this narrative get wrong about what played out in that early period of internet development in China?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. From my perspective and based on my research, I think definitely more and more this so-called dominant discourse around the Chinese internet is become more and more inadequate. Because as you mentioned, like for a long time, we think the only interest of China is to build this so-called inward-looking national intranet that is sealed by the Great Firewall, and that is actually unplugged from the international network. But from my research, this discourse actually suffers at least from two major points. First of all, people have this very idealized imagination of the potential democratized power of technology. So they often think that this network technology will free, especially the global South countries from authoritarianism. So in this way, they often think that the so-called Great Firewall, the only purpose of that is to contain this like freedom of speech and so forth. But the Great Firewall is not only a political tool. It is also an economic tool to shield the global tech giants from the Chinese market. And this is highly actually related to why China now has a group of globally prominent tech giants, precisely because in the early stage, the Chinese state using such a tool to protect or to reserve its domestic market for its homegrown tech giants.
So it bought the tech industry in China time to develop their own products to then go out and compete with the American tech companies later.
Yes. So for sure, the Great Firewall has its political aspect, political control, but also it is also an economical shield. And on the other hand, I think the second major misunderstanding of this dominant discourse is I think it overlooked China's relationship with the global internet. That is, the rise of China's global internet is actually being assisted by transnational capital. For example, we can recall that Yahoo was actually one of the early investors in Alibaba. And in 2005, it actually owned literally 30% of the company. So until very recently, Alibaba was like more owned by transnational capital than Chinese-owned national capital.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it is remarkable when you think about sort of another largely Western narrative that's emerged, which is of the close proximity and symbiosis or even control of Chinese tech companies by the Chinese state. Talk more about that narrative and how that misses some of the nuances.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a great point. So the dominant discourse often perceives China's especially outward digital expansion as a coherent government action. So Chinese state is indeed dictating those companies for their actions. But actually, I think this perception is overly simplistic. So we often see actually conflicts not only among different Chinese internet capitals, but also between those internet capitals and state entities. I think the most recent cancellation of Ant's IPO is a great example to illustrate this point.
We've been following the prospective IPO of Ant Financial, the largest initial public offering of all time. All of that appears this morning to be going up in smoke. The Shanghai Exchange, and we also know Hong Kong as well, have both essentially suspended the listing this morning.
This does come after Jack Ma, as well as other top executives at Ant, had been summoned on Monday to talk to the regulators at the banks. And it also comes after a speech that he made on Friday, in which he was highly critical of regulators for not supporting the fintech industry enough.
Let's hear more about that, because I think, again, from watching this somewhat naively from the outside, I think that shocked a lot of people. People who assumed Chinese tech companies, even if there was some foreign capital coming into it, were working in much more close alignment to Chinese policy. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you have one of the biggest tech companies in the world, and one of the most prominent heads of it, seemingly in conflict with the Chinese state. So maybe you could just some framing for our listeners. And so, what is Alibaba, and what happened there over the past year?
So I think now probably many of us have aware of that Alibaba is one of the most powerful e-commerce company, not only in China, but also in global internet. So basically, it's a combination of Amazon and eBay, and it also commands through a variety of financial vehicles, like one of the most valuable fintech tool in the world that is so-called Alipay, the mobile payment system that is so widely adopted in China and in many Southeast Asia countries.
And used for everything, right? I mean, it's a full payment system.
Yeah, exactly. So in one of my papers, I argue that this is Alipay has become infrastructuralized in China, means people use it basically as a basic financial infrastructure.
Yeah, you've written, I think, that you can't even buy apples without mobile payment.
Yeah, exactly. Even beggars on the street are using Alipay to receive donations. So you can see how popular it is. So then suddenly, I think it's actually, yeah, that's another point I want to emphasize, that is there is a much needed historical perspective we need to adopt to look at the relationship between internet capitals and Chinese state entities. So if you look at the development of Alipay in the past 10 years, there are actually existing a number of conflicting points. So the cancellation of Ant's IPO is only the recent, probably most prominent points in this longer history. So this by no means to say like, Jack Ma has always have a good relationship with Chinese regulators, and until recently, that is not correct. So if you look at history, you can see there are a number of conflicts and power struggles between Alipay, different entities of Chinese state apparatus, and even local governments in this longer history. Then starting from, I think, last year, we indeed saw much more prominent conflicts between Alipay and Chinese state entities. In particular, there is an event, so Jack Ma stepping out of the line in public criticism of the banking regulators in China. Basically, he's repeating lots of points he has raised out over the years that the Chinese banking industry is too old-fashioned and needs like digital interrupters, very similar to the discourse we heard actually around the world. So then suddenly, the upcoming and IPO was suspended by the Chinese regulators.
I mean, this is clearly a more global company that often gets attributed to it, with some more distance from the Chinese state than maybe people were aware of. But you also argue that it's not really a fully capitalist company either. It almost feels like it's something different than we're used. It's not a state-owned company. We understand as public utilities and those sorts of things, or a pure binary private entity. It seems to be some sort of hybrid. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think there's a like larger background that often being overlooked in the current discourse. That is, we often assume that China is already, you know, a market economy, but especially the CCP was still holding this so-called socialist ideology in its control of its domestic and even global expansion. So Alibaba, in many, many cases, it needs to not only like act in the direction of CCP's guidelines, but at least it has to pretend, you know, it's like really listen to state regulators in some sense. So if you look at Alipay and Alibaba's domestic initiatives, many of those initiatives, like they're building rural shopping site called Rural Taobao in China, really, really remote areas, try to help the rural populations to get rich, to get rid of the poverty, try to help them to sell their local products. Sometimes those initiatives doesn't really make sense for a private company because it doesn't really make too much profits and so forth. But it's part of the political obligations of those companies that needs to be operate in China.
I think the other thing that was surprising to many people about these recent events around Alibaba was that there is fairly robust competition policy enforcement occurring at the moment in China. Mm-hmm. And is that almost a reaction to the protectionist policies that allowed these companies to get so large that now the government is sort of worried about their scale and a lack of innovation in the tech sector? So they're pushing back against that scale? Is some of them reaping what they sowed with that protectionism?
I think Chinese government is really drawing the governments all over the world try to tackle the influence and power of big tech companies in its domestic market. So in some sense, it's a shared concern across governments all over the world. I think compared to other countries, especially the US and EU, China doesn't really have a very strong anti-monopoly regulations implemented in its domestic market. My anticipation is, it might not be correct. My anticipation is probably in the future, there will be a hybrid type of organizations emerge. So probably the government will have some control of the. So I think a government is really concerned about the power and influence of its domestic internet capital, because they're simply because they're getting too big. And they're getting too big partly because what you said, the protectionism policy. And also, I think we should be aware of the numerous waves of foreign capital injected into those companies. So this is why China facing the same problem as the global internet industry, because, you know, they are funded actually by the same type of capital that is very, very short-sighted. They need to get big first. They need to, in order to get, you know, dominant in their own market. So those problems, from my perspective, they're global problems.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the global nature of these companies too, and the global ambitions of the Chinese state. Another sort of broad common narrative is that some of the expansion of these companies, whether it be Huawei or Alipay, whatever it might be, into global markets, is in some ways part of Chinese foreign policy. And that this is somehow part of a much broader geopolitical dynamic, where the Chinese state is using this technology infrastructure to either gain political advantage or geopolitical advantage globally. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that. And maybe first, I know you've worked a lot in this space, so I'd like to sort of get a bit of some of the grounding here. And so what is the Belt and Road Initiative, and what is the Chinese government trying to do there? And then we can talk a bit about how technology fits into that.
So the Belt and Road Initiative is one of the most prominent foreign policy initiatives in China. Like, it was basically initiated by the highest level of leadership in China. In this case, it's by Xi Jinping himself, tried to connect China through Europe, both through the land road and the sea road. It's similar to many Chinese high-level initiatives. This Belt and Road Initiative is very, very opaque and sometimes intended to be ambiguous. So to allow different government entities and its state-owned companies and private companies to have room to interpret this very high-level strategy. And then we saw, really, because of this is concurrent with the rise of China's internet industry, so we saw more and more in the policy discourse, people do talk about the digital component of the Belt and Road Initiative, which we often call the Digital Silk Road.
And so what are the components of that? If you think of different layers of the technology stack, what companies and what technologies are being exported and to whom via the Digital Silk Road?
So if we're talking about infrastructure layers, there are three layers. One is the equipment vendors. Those are Huawei, ZTE, Xiaomi, even Lenovo and so forth. They're producing the hardware of this Digital Silk Road. Then in the middle layer, we saw Chinese telecom operators, China Telecom, China Unicom, China Mobile. Those are telecom operators, but they're busy actually in building overseas telecom infrastructures. So both basically those are really the hardware of global connectivity. Then the higher layer is the internet application and service providers. We just covered like Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, or TikTok. So those three layers constitutes the so-called Digital Silk Road.
And what do you think is the motivation for this?
Yeah, okay, great question. I think there are a number of motivations. Basically, the timing of the digital Silk Road is very critical. That is, China is facing a serious both political and economic crisis within China. Especially, there is a huge industrial overcapacity inside China. So China needs some external expansion strategies to use that industrial overcapacities to build different infrastructures in the world.
So they need access to new markets, essentially, for these companies to say the scale they are and to keep this production capacity?
Yes, exactly.
So you're saying it's largely an economic driver is what's going on here.
Yeah, but also there's a political motivations as well. Especially if you're looking at the internet aspect of Belt and Road. At the same time, there is the so-called Snowden disclosed that the spy agency from the U.S. is really spying around the world. Then we saw many countries in the global south is trying to build the so-called BRICS cable. Then China was part of the initiative. Then China actually think it needs a separate global digital infrastructure that is different from the current U.S. dominated. So that's kind of another political layer as well. So this is why digital Silk Road actually is a very important component of the Silk Road, because China needs to build a China-centered transnational network infrastructure for its own development, both political and economic.
So for a long time, there was a narrative that China's global role was purely in service of domestic priorities, and that it didn't really have any colonial ambitions in the same way as we've looked at other previous powers. They didn't want to change the politics in countries. They didn't want to have permanent presence in countries around the world in the same way the British Empire or the American Empire might have aspired to. There is a different narrative, though, that's emerging, including in reports from the U.S. Senate and the way the U.S. is kind of pushing a lot of this discourse at the moment, that China also has political ambitions over the countries in which it is expanding some of these digital capacities. And that might mean not just some of this base technology infrastructure, but actually also exporting some of the tools that the Chinese state uses, either to survey its population or to control in some capacity its population. And if that's the case, that has real political implications in some of these countries. If these are being exported to a liberal-leaning regimes, for example, how does that fit in? That narrative fit in with this? Is there a desire to solidify illiberalism through this foreign policy as well?
That's a good question. First of all, I don't have empirical data to say whether China is really exporting surveillance technology to other countries or not. So that's an open question for me as well. I don't have an answer for that. But I think the current framework that is trying to frame China's outward expansion in the global internet as, internet freedom versus authoritarian surveillance is a little bit inadequate and sometimes even a little bit misleading. Because if you look at China's own domestic discourse, its expansion towards especially Africa countries was framed as the so-called South-South cooperation between China and Africa, which has a long history dated back into 1950s. So there are certain discrepancies between the dominant Western discourse and China's domestic discourse. And I think at least we should bring those two discourses together and carefully analyze on the ground details, empirical evidence of what is actually happening with the China's global expansion, instead of assuming one of them is correct and one of them is simply a liar.
I think that's important nuance there. I think one of the reasons it gets framed like that is because some of the statements that have been made around the importance the state's placing in AI and in quantum computing and in the real capacity change that could emerge from the combination of those, certainly. And a bit of an arms race emerging with the US in both of those spaces. Are you concerned about that kind of arms race narrative? These are two potentially very, very powerful and transformative technologies. And in some ways, the Chinese government looks better positioned to develop both of them than more open free markets. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. I heard those narratives all the time, the great power competitions between China and the US in AI. And it makes me concerned, not only because, the simplistic, portray of both China and the US, but also sometimes in my classroom, when I raise, critical points towards, the development of AI, in general, not in China, then my student will say, well, if we don't do that, then Chinese will be doing that. So that's a very deeply troubling argument. Then I will say, it's not race to the bottom competition, right? And also, I think it's important to recognize that the development of AI and quantum computing and 5G, there's a globally distributed production chain. So it's not really China is developing this and US is developing an alternative. It's basically all the countries, maybe the at least US, China, are working together in some areas to develop AI in certain sense. If you look at especially the labor behind AI, the Chinese, image laboring workers are actually labeling image for US AI startups. So it's not really US versus China in some sense. And I think there's a great opportunity actually for countries to work together to look at the labor resistance and the politics behind AI innovations. Simply because US-China actually facing same type of problems, labor exploitation, labor resistance, we can do better to help those people instead of saying if Chinese don't do that, if we don't do that, then Chinese will be doing that.
Yeah, that's an important point here, that there are a whole host of common, potentially objectives, not between nation states here, but between citizens of both countries. And it feels to me like that might be a way in to a more productive governance conversation, where
exactly.
There are some sort of collective global problems that are emerging in this space. But one of the real stumbling blocks in the global governance of AI conversation has really been a perception, I think, in Western democracies that China will not abide by global governance regimes in the AI space. And that stems from, I think, a legitimate concern that China has always promoted its own sovereignty over, or prioritized sovereignty over, participation in active global governance regimes. But do you think there's a window of opportunity here? Is there a space for a global governance conversation of these emerging technologies that China would participate in?
Sure. I think, as we mentioned in this chat, that China is not a monolithic authoritarian state in general. So there are different divisions inside the state apparatus. And we have critical scholars and critical divisions inside state apparatus as well, that they're going to promote a more human global governance regime as well. If you look at Chinese domestic policy discourse, it's much more complicated and richer than we often imagine from an outsider's perspective. So people are indeed debating with each other. So which road should China do? Which action should China take in the next 5 to 10 years? And people, there's very first domestic criticism against labor exploitation behind AI industries as well. So I do think there are some common ground we can build. And it's our job as critical scholars to help build those common ground, to shape those policy debate, to really critically look at the so-called global AI industries and what we can do for the people actually who are mostly impacted by those systems collectively.
And what would you think, just to close here, I'm curious on that point, where would you, if you were looking at developing certain governance regimes for either AI or data privacy or telecommunications regulation, whatever it might be globally, where do you think the most fruitful opportunity is for collaboration?
So from my perspective, I think labor rights, especially, if you look at the labor behind those tech industries, is definitely one of the highest priority. Chinese government is taking some actions towards there. And also, I think the center of this podcast is how to regulate big tech monopoly tech companies, both in China and in other countries, will be a very fruitful conversation. We can build a fruitful conversation over there as well.
Because so, it's already happening there. I mean, they're already doing it domestically, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, I mean, look, this is just the start of a much longer conversation, I think. And thank you so much for speaking with us.
No, thanks for hosting me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise. That was my conversation with Hong Shen. As always, you can reach me at taylor@bigtechpodcast.com. Big Tech is presented by the Center for International Governance Innovation and produced by Antica Productions. Please consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We release new episodes on Thursdays every other week.